You're listening to the Writer's Digest podcast with Gabriella Pereira, the show to help ignite your creative vision so you can write better and get published. Welcome, welcome, writers, from fiction to nonfiction, whatever your genre persuasion, whether you write heartwarming bedtime stories about Jack the Ripper or historical romantic vampire fiction. Can you tell it's our Halloween episode? We are so thrilled to have you here for another episode of the Writer's Digest podcast. This podcast is produced by Writer's Digest, the largest online writing community and educational website in the world. I'm Gabriella Pereira, founder of DIYMFA.com and your host for this show. Now, before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the show notes for this episode are at writersdigest.com/EP9 or EP9. Also, this episode of the Writer's Digest podcast is brought to you by the Writer's Digest Novel Writing Conference. The Novel Writing Conference is returning to Pasadena, California on October 26th through 28, 2018. Immerse yourself in inspiration and advice from publishing's most respected and knowledgeable writers, agents, and editors, who will guide you through the process of writing, editing, and publishing your novel. Hone your craft, refine your characters, explore the future of publishing, and get the tools you need to advance your career as a successful novelist. Now, today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Heather Graham. Heather is an award-winning New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of over 200 novels in a broad range of categories and genres. Her background is fascinating and varied, proving that there is no one pathway to publication. She started her career by majoring in theater arts at the University of South Florida, and after a stint of several years in dinner theater, doing backup vocals and bartending, she decided after the birth of her third child to stay home and start writing. Since that time, she has written over 200 novels and novellas, including suspense, historical romance, vampire fiction, time travel, occult, and Christmas family fare. She has been honored with awards from booksellers and writers' organizations for excellence in her work, and she is also the recipient of the Silver Bullet from International Thriller Writers, and she also received their prestigious Thriller Master Award in 2016. She's also the recipient of a Lifetime Achievement Award from RWA. Heather loves travel and anything that has to do with water. She's a certified scuba diver and also loves ballroom dancing. For the past several years, she has hosted the Vampire Ball and Dinner Theater at the Romantic Times Convention, or RT Convention, raising money for the Pediatric AIDS Society. In 2006, she hosted the first Writers for New Orleans workshop to benefit the stricken Gulf region. And this is an awesome event. At the time that we were recording this intro and this episode, it was actually happening right at that same time. She is the founder of the Slush Pile Players, which is a theater group slash band that basically does something resembling entertainment. These are Heather's words. And they present at various conferences and benefits, etc. Heather's been married since high school graduation and is the mother of five. Her greatest love in life remains her family, but she also believes her career has been an incredible gift, and she is very grateful every day to be doing something that she loves so very much for a living. As you will hear in this episode, Heather is a truly inspiring, warm-hearted human being, and I am so thrilled to have her on the show today. So listen in while Heather and I dish about all things writing. Welcome, Heather. It is so great to have you on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's so great to be on the show. Thanks.
So I usually like to start these interviews by asking people to share their story behind the story. Basically, I think of writing as a superpower and writers as superheroes. So if you were going to share your writing superhero origin story, what would that be?
Well, this may not go exactly in the right direction. When I was young, I was a theater major, and I absolutely loved what I did. I got out of school, and I worked dinner theater I was in Florida, and we're right to work state. And of course, I was not making a great deal of money. I loved what I did, and I was able to get a few commercials. And I think somebody was telling me something when my dog and I were both hired for the same commercial. This is a little exercise machine, and the little motto was, "Everybody's doing it." The dog was paid more money than I was, so I don't know if that was kind of a direction things were going in, but it was very hard to survive. And the thing was, I actually met my husband when I was 14 or 15, and I got married the minute I was out of high school. And once we started having children, it was kind of like I had not been discovered, probably maybe never would have been. But I had loved what I did. But anyway, once we had the kids, it was just too expensive for me to be going out to auditions. And so that was when I started writing. And, the one thing I think that of everyone I know who does wind up being successful, no matter how they're publishing these days, is I loved to read. I was very lucky for one thing. I had parents who loved to read, so my house was just full of all kinds of things that you could pick up. And, from the love of reading, I think that's what makes us want to write. And I think it's important to always keep reading. But back then, of course, it wasn't internet, so I would write things off, and then I would have to wait several weeks for sometimes a mimeographed rejection notice. It could be fairly depressing, but I really wanted it. And it always excites me to do things for Writer's Digest, because I would not be published without it. I bought Writer's Digest, Writer's Market, and I was sending off to, I think the first thing I sold was actually a short horror story. And then the first book that I was finally picked up, I think I spent about 2 years being rejected. And the first one, the book that was picked up was with, what was at the time, Dell Publications. So, and then I think I have one of the best stories with that too, because I finally was able to talk to the editor. Things were much slower when things were phone calls and letters and things like that. But when I was speaking with her, she said, "Okay, and do you have anything else?" And I said, "Well, yes, I have a couple of things, but I sent them in, but they were rejected." She goes, "Oh, well, I would like to see them." And I said, "They were rejected by you." And she said, "I would like to see them anyway." And at that point, I kind of realized that if they were going to pick up one book, unless it's, a super book about a timely event or a biography or something like that, people are looking for more than one book, as in editors and publishing houses. So once they had purchased the one book, they were willing to put more effort into, helping me learn as a writer, or, to move into the editorial process. So I always think people should hold on to everything, because you never know when you're going to have the brilliant idea on how to change it or fix it, or when maybe it was okay to begin with, but it wasn't what the market wanted. And then all of a sudden the market comes around and it's what they want. So it's a good thing to, hold on to what we believe in a lot, and always keep, I don't think people do keep material anyway, but you just never know when it might be the right time for that material.
Okay. So there is so much we need to unpack in everything you just said. But the first thing I want to do is just take an OMG moment and be like, OMG, Heather Graham was a Writer's Digest success story. And wrap my head around that. That's like amazing. Absolutely. That's like so reassuring to me, because now I'm like, oh my gosh, if you could do it, like we can all do it. That's so, so reassuring. I love that. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh yeah, no, it's so important. I still recommend it constantly when I speak, because you've got it. Of course, timely, you have to have the Writer's Digest, Writer's Market for that year, because editors move, staff changes and everything like that. But it can save you from, if you have written a mystery, you don't want to send it to someone who is looking for a sweet romance. If you've written a romance, you don't want to send it to someone who's only purchasing sci-fi, unless it's a sci-fi romance. But you know what I mean. Writer's Digest gives you, and then there's also, if I'm not mistaken, there's still a book for agents too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, and now there's this whole newfangled thing called the internet where they have like these databases up there. And I think, I mean, I'm not involved with the inner workings of this, but my understanding is people can get like a subscription as well and have like the to the minute information.
And that's so important. It's so important. Yeah.
Absolutely. The other thing I wanted to unpack is like what you were saying about, you know, when you started, it was all mimeographs and, you know, faxes and snail mail, heaven forbid, people actually put things in the mail. I remember I had an internship in 2007 in a literary agency. That's how I got started. And at the agency actually where my agent is now, it's sort of this awesome come full circle story. But I remember having to put like physical rejection letters in an envelope and people had to send these self-addressed stamped envelopes with their submissions. And so all of that stuff, which is like a thing of the past now, it's so mind-blowing. But what's interesting too is that, like, you know, nowadays a lot of people, you know, one of the complaints I hear from a lot of writers is it's so slow, it's all hurry up and wait, and we have to wait for so long to hear anything. And so, like, I just want to sort of put that in perspective for our listeners that, like, it was even more of a wait back then than it is now. Like, back then it was a wait both because of logistics and because publishing took time, as opposed to now where it's just because publishing takes time.
Well, you know, I kind of had this image. I'll never forget the first time I had gone up to New York to meet with an editor. And I think this happens for a lot of us who just love books and reading. I assumed an editor, you know, any editor was going to have a massive office and they would have picture windows and it would be, you know, this tremendous, beautiful place because, of course, everybody would worship editors. And then you get to New York and you find out that, you know, they are in little rooms and they have millions, maybe not so bad now that we're on the internet, but I mean, the first time I went up there were just stacks everywhere, the slush pile. And it takes time to read. And the thing I think that people don't always think of too is one thing I try to remind people when they're nervous and they're pitching is, you know, you're looking for a good place for your work. Editors are looking for great books too. You know, they want to be able to work on great books. They want to find authors. They want to be the one to, you know, to help grow you. It's slow, yes, but that's because editors actually are human. So it takes a certain amount of time to do things and to get back with people. Obviously, some houses are better than others, you know, but depends on where you want to go.
And great work takes time. I mean, it takes time to write and it also takes time to, you know, edit and produce. So I think having, you know, there is this mindset, I think, in our industry to some degree. And, you know, it's one that I've often felt like I wanted to speak out against, the sort of us versus them, that it's like the writers versus the editors. And that is so not, in my mind, the way it is or the way it should be. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
I think that you hit it right on the nail. It's definitely not a we and a they. It's completely a work between two people. It's one thing I had mentioned to you when we were just chatting by ourselves. I'm in New Orleans right now for a little benefit conference that we do down here. And I'm absolutely thrilled because my actual hands-on editor is going to be able to be here this year. I love working with this woman. She's very good about, let me take a little back step here. I'm going to take a big back step and hope you don't mind. Years ago, I was at a Novelist Inc. conference and there was a writer, at Novelist Inc., they do a little thing where there are editors and agents on a panel and it's kind of like you get to grill them. You know, hopefully it's, you're going to get to learn some things. Usually, I believe it still is a professional conference. So everybody's been published and everybody has a job working for, you know, one of the traditional houses. But an author stood up and looked at the editors and really attacked them, you know, and she said, you know, with the internet coming in and with our ability to put books up on E, you're going to become a thing of the past. And she said, all anybody is going to need is someone who can line edit and then somebody who can proofread and then somebody who knows something about marketing and then, you know, somebody who can do like a cover and then maybe advertising. And it's kind of like everybody's just looking at her and thinking, that's what publishing means. You know, it's a complete gamut of making the book the best possible product that it can be. And I kind of hate to say product, the writing, but it still is. And that, to me, is one of the biggest problems we have. I think that E and the ability for people to self-publish is amazing and wonderful. I think it's a great thing. But it goes back to what this rule is saying. If you're going to do that, you know, use the word publish. Publishing means not just somebody who's proofed, but somebody who's line edited, meaning, you know, that you're going to find out, oh, you've got a great big gap here, or this scene does not agree with this scene. This hero, I'm not visualizing him. I'm not seeing anything. That's what line editing is, really fleshing out your story and making it the best possible. Or even things too. I mean, with this is big line and regular. I remember I was reading something online, and I think the guy's name was Steve, and Steve stood up 5 times on the same page. And I don't think he ever sat down, but, it's completely really following continuity, which of course can be in proofing too. But I mean, there's just so much to a really good editorial process that you really don't want to write something and just run it through spell check and put it up. You know, you want to have the care put into your work, whether it's traditional, small press, or self-pub. You know, you need to go through the steps that create like a, you know, something that's really published.
Absolutely. You know, so my book came out with Writer's Digest a couple of years back, and I remember sort of reflecting on the editing process. And, you know, I believe firmly that editors are the writer's biggest allies, and that the editor, like a good editor, like a solid editor, when they're doing their job, they take your writing to a place where you never would have been able to reach on your own. And that was definitely what I felt. But I had a truly great editor. I didn't just have a good editor. I had one who was like off the charts phenomenal. And what was so amazing about how she did what she did is that she was able to elevate my writing to this whole other level without leaving her fingerprints on the writing. And that's very hard to do.
I'm in awe of them.
Absolutely. Like, I go back and I look at the places that I know we worked on and we like edited together, and I can't tell the pieces of those sentences that were hers and the pieces that were mine. Like, they just mesh so perfectly that, and that's like, I mean, editing is like this magical superpower that's sort of akin to ghostwriting, but also editing and like the quality control element. Like, it's just, it blows my mind.
Oh, I think so too. And it's funny. I mean, the things that we can do that we don't think of. I remember this years ago when I had written one. I think it's great when they have a sense of humor too, because my editor wrote on the page, you know, I took out her biting her lip this time because I was so afraid if she bit it one more time, it would fall right off. She really wasn't being snarky. She was, you know, we were friends by then. I was just like, ooh, I guess I really did overdo that. But I mean, we all do that. There's things that, you know, I mean, we even do it in our pattern of speech when we're with friends. So on the written page, we have to, you know, watch out for it. And good editors are, as you said, they just elevate, they find things. And then the other thing, it's kind of like the bird in the hand, or the bird, you know, when you see those little things wherever words are placed, you don't see it. Your eyes will read it as the bird in the hand. It's the same thing. What's in our heads is what we're seeing sometimes. So the fresh eyes on a project are just incredibly important.
Absolutely. And while I like what you said about the self-publishing, that like, there is certainly a way that writers can self-publish. What I often tell people when they are thinking about self-publishing is that the minute you take that step, you are no longer a writer who is self-publishing. You are a publisher who happens to also produce the writing as part of that process. And it's like suddenly the publishing piece of it and being able to coordinate all those moving parts has to be the predominant element, the driving thrust. And what I, you know, a lot of times people will complain like, well, oh, traditional publishing, it's, you know, it's so hard on the writer. You don't get great deals and yada yada and good royalties. I think of it as like, we're paying for the privilege of one-stop shopping and having one place that handles the whole kit and caboodle. And, you know, for some writers, they want to do it themselves. That's great. But I'd much rather just hand it over and say, all right, you take care of it. And then I can do what I want to do, which is the writing.
Well, I think that's really important because I have met a few people, I mean, out of hundreds, thousands, a few people who really are, you know, fine writers, and they are capable of creating beautiful covers, and they actually know something about marketing. And, you know, I mean, there are every once in a while, but it's exactly what you were just saying. I'm not a good marketer, and I don't want to be. I did exactly the same thing. I love writing. You know, I mean, I love that part of it. And so I know I'm not good at other things. This doesn't mean I don't put things up now and then. I do, because a lot of times I've done something, you know, like a short story or a novella that was part of a benefit for someone, and then I'll put it up myself. But it's still, I still don't want to, you know, I hire people to do a cover. I hire people to edit. I hire people. And I'm not saying you can't. I'm just saying I can't. And an awful lot of people can't. But it's so big today that if you do your research, you know, I mean, anything needs research. Make sure you look people up online, find out what they've worked on. There are amazing editors out there who you can, you know, hire. Writer's Digest, I believe you can go, I'm not mistaken here, I don't think, offers, I could be mistaken. But I mean, if you read in all these different things, whether it is self-pub or traditional houses, you do the research and find out how to do things correctly. Or if going back into traditional, the same thing with an agent, find out if this is a standard one. You know, oh my God, he's the best agent in the world. No, he or she needs to be the best agent for you. They have to love your work. They have to get your work going. So it's just one of those things where you always need to be paying attention to what you're doing. And as far as that goes, like you were saying, it's just the same thing. I like writing. I don't like doing the other part of it. So I'm very happy and very grateful, actually, that a guy got in what I did.
I love that. So I want to backtrack a little bit and go back to sort of time travel back to when you were first getting started, because this was another piece of that very beginning discussion that I wanted to unpack. The fact that you started writing while you had three children at home, as a mother of two small children, I am still trying to wrap my head around this concept. So, you know, one of the struggles that I hear from writers, and writers bring up again and again, you know, especially DIY MFA word nerds, how do we find time to write? And I've got very strong opinions on this matter. I don't think time is like loose change you find like tucked between seat cushions and your couch. I think it's something you have to carve out and make. It doesn't just magically appear. So, but I wanted to hear your take on that. How did you do it with a full life already on your hands? How did you find or make the time to write around everything else that was happening?
Well, I think this is just another thing. To me, to become published or self-published, whichever you wish to do, you do have to absolutely dedicate time. And it doesn't mean for some people that could be 40 hours a week. For some people, it could be 80. For some people, it could be 2. But if you've said you're going to work 2 hours a week, you do need to work those 2 hours every week and not, oh, no, I'm, you know, something else is happening today. Or having said that, though, life happens. They always love the John Lennon thing. I think it was John Lennon. He said, life is what happens while we're busy making plans. So, I mean, there are things in life that will get in your way and, you know, you will have to take a few detours. But just because you've made a detour doesn't mean that, you know, you completely forget where you're going. You get right back on track. I just think that you, whatever it is that you dedicate, you really have to be dedicated. And of course, it is hard when you have little ones, and especially when you have more than one, because, well, even with two, you know that they don't naturally sleep at the same time. You know, they're going to be doing all kinds of different things. So it's tough. I don't know. I was very, very lucky. My mother and my mother-in-law were both alive at the time the kids were young, and they would help out. In fact, my mother-in-law was hysterical because my mother and father-in-law were both Italian and had very specific ideas on how work is important and doing different things is important. But my mother-in-law would call me when I was trying to get published, and she would say something, and she, what are you doing? And I would say, well, you know, I'm typing, I'm working on the story. Oh, good, you're not busy. And then once I was published and it was actually a job and I was making money, she would fight you tooth and nail if you were trying to get near me when I was working. So sometimes in some ways that is going to make a difference in life, how much help you're going to have. But even now, I think you and I were just chatting. I have been staying with my daughter who just had a baby, and it just seems to be such a different thing watching her one little one and my own five. And I think part of it is with our own children, we kind of know what we're doing and we're feeling our way. And then once it's somebody else's child, you're way more, not that you don't love your own dearly, but you're also having to take into consideration, you know, what they feel. Oh my God, they left the baby with you and the baby's crying. Like, you know, what's wrong? And my own, of course, obviously, you know, baby every once in a while just has to cry a little bit, but they all grew up and they're all, they're all functioning. So I'm hoping I did everything okay.
That's how I feel as well. I feel like, you know, as long as there's no blood, as long as, like, there's, you know, nobody, like, cracks their head open, we're...
Exactly. So, I mean, yeah, but it helps if you have, you know, family support, whether husband, wife, whichever, or in-laws or parents or cousins or, you know, friends, anybody, you know, who wants to give you some assistance. It helps. But even if you don't have that, you know, you have to find that 1 or 2 hours that you're always going to give to your work. And I think it's important to, and I think something that can be very hard for us is you've got to believe in yourself. And if you do, if you believe in yourself and you dedicate to it, I think you will eventually prevail.
That's such a great point, too. And it sort of ties to what you were saying about, you know, like the, oh, good, you're not busy thing. That, like, especially yeah. at the beginning, a lot of people, like, the only person who's going to take your writing seriously is you. And if you don't take it seriously, then how the heck is anybody else going to also get on that bandwagon? And it's a lot easier for them to get on the bandwagon once you've had, like, external markers of success. But in the beginning, if you're not holding strong to that idea, to that goal, everybody else is like, they don't know any better. They're going to step in your way, because not out of malice or trying to hurt you or derail you. They just don't know.
Well, I think there's one thing too. It's funny because, you know, there have been different terms for, I know years ago when you're an event, you were published or you were unpublished, and, you know, now it's kind of published or self-published or indie published, or, you know, and then somebody will say aspiring writers, and it's kind of like, well, and if you're writing, you're a writer. So you just have to go from that. Your writing is perhaps in an early stage. You're working on your craft, whatever. But if you're writing, you are a writer.
Yeah, I often will correct people and say, you're not an aspiring writer. You're just pre-published.
Or even, yeah, I mean, it just, that's what I mean. The English language writer, that's the act of writing. So if you're doing it, you just get it out there. You just keep working. One of my favorite things with books is kind of like know when to hold and know when to fold. And that's kind of something that I think you have to work on, because I think writing groups are absolutely wonderful. I knew no one when I started out. I mean, literally knew no one. So I was just doing everything blindly in the dark. But once you, I think knowing people is fabulous, and getting the if you can get to conferences, they're great. The interneting, the interacting is just, it's so phenomenal to have other people who are like-minded, and you learn so much from them about how to self-publish if that's what you wish to do, what companies are looking for what editors specifically are looking for what. You just learn so much from the networking that you get by going to conferences. Now, I think where you can run into danger is I had one friend who I thought she wrote a phenomenal prologue. And then she was reading it in a, you know, kind of a critique group, and 5 different people told her 5 different things. She rewrote it. By the time she rewrote it 5 times, she never picked the project up again. She just put it down. So you have to learn to listen to people and obviously kind of figure out, well, 10 people have said this is a cliche and horrible, then it probably is a cliche and horrible. But somebody might love a protagonist. Somebody might hate the plot while they love the protagonist. Or, you know what I mean? There's so many different, no matter what we do, it's subjective. Reading is subjective. So sometimes I think you have to try very hard to learn to take criticism and, you know, mull it and figure out what to do with it. And then again, sometimes, no, this is my story, and I think that that's where it should go. So, and I think it's, we never stop learning. You know, we never, ever stop on that. So, but it is something to think about.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. A mentor of mine once said that critique groups are great, but it's kind of like you're driving a van with like 15 backseat drivers.
Oh, I like that. That's good. Yeah.
And it's like you said, sometimes all 15 of them are like, you need to turn off at this exit right now. Oh no, you missed the exit. But sometimes it's like they're telling you 15 different places to go. And that's when you need to make up your own mind.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, it's always, in fact, that's one thing that I love about one of the editors that I worked with. Well, first of all, she was really funny because she would, the best editors always get you right off the bat, like, oh, I love this. This is wonderful. This was such a good story. I just have a few notes. And then there's 10 pages. but they've encouraged you to begin with. And then she always ended her notes with, you know, these are my opinions, but it's your story. So I think that, I think that's the, you know, the bottom line is you have to, well, I mean, then the other thing is too, is somebody, you know, talked to friends at various times, you're like, oh, so-and-so said I should change this, so-and-so said I could change this. And then it's kind of like, well, you know, if this particular editor is buying it or looking to buy it, then that's the one I would listen to, you know, unless it's obviously, unless it's something that you, you know, is against, completely against what you're doing, you know, and you're willing to wait and then, you know, hold your guns until you, you know, find the publication venue that, that you do want, that is going to work for you. But I mean, an awful lot of the time, things like that are, like I said, if they're buying it, their opinion is going to count more than anyone else's.
Absolutely. So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about, well, let's put it this way. Prolific does not even begin to describe your body of work. Like with all the, what is it, 200 plus novels and novellas, different categories, genres, basically you name it, like I name it, you've written it. And so this is sort of a two-part question. First, I wanted to talk about sort of how you juggle these different styles and types of writing, sort of from a professional level. Like if you're working on multiple projects or you've got different things sort of in the pipeline, how you juggle it all. But I also wanted to find out from you, the second part of the question, whether there are common threads or themes that you've noticed that run through your books sort of over the long haul.
I think it's impossible for us to write without some of us, you know, slipping into whatever we're doing. And this is, I guess, in a way, a little bit of a dangerous topic. I had one of the worst pieces of hate mail I think I've ever seen on a book that I had out recently. But it was a project near and dear to my heart, and hopefully, you know, other people enjoyed it. But I'm a big believer in people. I am a huge believer in us all being absolutely equal, no matter what our color, creed, sex, sexual preference. I mean, just anything. And I am a child of immigrants. My dad was Scottish, my mother was Irish, and so the American dream is very important to me too. But I have so many friends who, and I live in Miami, which is, it's so mixed at the moment, but, which is, I think, wonderful. But I have friends who went through really terrible things trying to get to the United States. And a lot of them had tried to do it properly. You know, very good friend, she came when she was about 4 or 5, but her mother thought she was coming through a church group. She had scrimped and saved, and she had gotten together $20,000, and it wound up being a complete scam. They were dropped in the Texas desert with nothing. To this day, I mean, she's still working, even though her daughter now has a great job, but she still likes to work because she likes to be very independent. But she just spent 30 years working 3 different shifts, you know, literally cleaning anything. And then she earned her citizenship. But she had friends who'd been in the whole kind of like, you know, the white slavery market thing that does go on in the United States. So, I mean, I don't know what our laws should be. I don't know how we should do anything. I'm not claiming to know that. But I do think that we definitely have to clamp down on the terrible things that can happen to people. So, like I said, I'm sure that my feelings about people in general come through. I mean, I'm going to love you no matter what you are. Unless you do something evil to me, and then I'm not going to like you no matter who you are. So, and I'm sure that that comes through on things.
You know, and that segues so beautifully to another thing that I wanted to talk to you about. So you alluded before to the Writers for New Orleans workshop, and you've also done other projects that have sort of, I want to say like kind of a public service type of bent, like the Vampire Ball and Dinner Theater at the RT convention that helps raise money for, what is it? Is it Pediatric AIDS?
Mine's usually the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Fund, but we will do, it depends. We had in New Orleans, we had James Rollins down as our guest speaker once, and he really is a vet. So we put all of our efforts that year towards the many displaced animals. You know, we went, donated to all the animal shelters in the area. So sometimes it depends on what we're doing. The Pediatric AIDS started off with I don't even know what year it was. It was so long ago when we started doing the vampire party. I had written a vampire series, and then it was like, you know, just a concept of blood. And so, okay, then we need to do something, you know, we need to benefit something that has to do with it. So, you know, blood. And then It's heartbreaking when children are affected by something that, I hate to see children suffer. So the Pediatric AIDS, Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation was an important one. We thought that would be a good one to work towards. But then again, we also did 1 year right after 9/11. This was lovely because Stephen Zacharias, I remember Kensington Zebra at the time, we raised, I forget how many thousand dollars. We really did a pretty good job at it. And he matched everything that we made to donate to the New York Fire Department. It's the most fun thing in the world to do things and be able to make something, something a little bit good out of them too.
So the reason I wanted to bring up these projects that you've done is because one of the things I hear a lot from writers and word nerds in the DIY MFA community is, this, especially in this day and age, is this feeling of what could we possibly do? Things are falling apart. We're not superheroes. We're just writers. All we have are our words. How can we make a difference? And clearly you've been using the power of your platform, the power of your words to make a positive, pragmatic difference. So can you talk a little bit about sort of what writers could potentially be doing using the power of their writing, their words, and what they're doing on the page in order to help maybe affect some positive change in the world?
Well, I think one of the things we always say, there's this saying that's older than dirt is, the power of the pen is greater than that of the sword. Not that any of us is using a pen anymore. No, that's not true. I know people who do still write longhand. So I think it's, and not that I don't think we're, at least, that this particular line, we are writing fiction, we're writing stories, we're writing entertainment. And I think a lot of the time, people have done things that they don't realize. Because I think one of them, over the years I've had it happen a couple of times where somebody would come up to me and tell me how grateful they were that they had the book because the book helped get them through the death of a parent, a spouse, a loved one. So I think writers often are doing things that they don't even know about, but because the book will be so important to one individual that it can change them. The power of our words, too, is, as I said, it just, not like them. I'm not setting out to change anybody. I'm not setting out to do, anything particular. I am writing fiction, but our thoughts and the way we feel will come out, and hopefully find like-minded people or make people think, about some of the things that we're doing. I said it's not that you're setting out to bonk anybody on the head. You will let people know how you feel, and it's my argument with anything out there. I'm very. I get very upset when people are just mean. If you have a good argument, give me a good argument. Don't just be mean about it. And I think we have the power to do that. We don't have to be nasty. We don't have to make enemies out of anybody. We can just put forward in our own little ways how we feel or think. And sometimes make people see things different ways. And then as far as what you're saying, too, there are so many things that we can do that I think are important. Sending books overseas to our armed forces. I'm from the South, so we see an awful lot of storm damages. It's not different places each year, but the libraries afterwards can desperately use books. So books that you're done with, you can, get going and get them places where they're needed. And especially because if you're from a storm area, it's funny. I always feel sorry for Northerners because I figure, oh my God, if you're out in a blizzard, you're going to freeze to death. Now, I grant you in Florida, we can steam horribly. But, it's not as bad as, worried about, are you literally going to freeze at night? But when electricity is gone, your internet is not going to be up. And unless you've really got planned ahead, a lot of your things aren't going to be working. What is better than a book? A book does not. It doesn't need a battery. Well, some do now, but if you have a book in your hand, you've got that book no matter what's going on. So I think those definitely help people a lot. A lot of hospitals take books. And, if you are successful, there are all kinds of things. I've noticed on Facebook, I see a lot now where people dedicate their birthdays, and bring up different causes that are important to them. So I do think we can do things. But then again, too, it's like, and you're going to win me with an intelligent argument every time over calling me a name. And so I think that we can do a lot of that with our writing.
Absolutely. And I love what you said about sort of how our own sort of beliefs and values will come through just naturally in our writing. And it made me think of some years ago, I was interviewing an author, I think it was Carolyn Mackler on the DIY MFA podcast, and she brought up this idea of it's not just about showing the world as it is, it's about showing the world as we'd like it to be. And sort of by modeling on the page, sort of what we really would desire our world to be, the good behavior, the kindness that we'd like to see in the world. And I think that that's just, that was such a beautiful way, and it ties so nicely to what you were saying of sort of using our words. Like, it's not about being preachy, but if we model what a good world could look like, then maybe that can sink in as people read our stories.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, I'm thinking that when I'm also sitting here thinking that I write a lot of serial killers and people who absolutely rip people to shreds. But and it's so funny too about anything that anybody is writing is there's an editor who passed away several years ago, but who I adored. She had worked for many of the places. She was one of the biggest proponents of romance ever. Her name was Kate Duffy. And I just loved her. She had the most brilliant mind. But somebody was saying one time about being, you know, like, oh, this is, you know, people are just being too picky, this, that, and everything. It's not like we're writing the great American classic. And she was quiet for a minute, and she said, you never know what you're writing. Shakespeare was not a classic during Shakespeare's day, you know? So you have no idea what it is that may become, you know, so important 100 years from now. So, and it's not that it has to either, but we just don't always know what it is that we're putting on paper, what effect it will have where. And then again, like I said, just writers in general, it's so incredible when you do see someone who will tell you that what you wrote got them through a rough time, you know, just in, you know, might be an individual and it might be, oh, well, it was one person. Yeah, it was one person. And that one person's life was very important and you affected it.
That's amazing. That's so inspiring. Thank you so much for sharing this perspective, because I think it's something that we writers need to hear, because it can feel sometimes like we've got, you know, our hands are bound. There's nothing we can do. And yet there are things we can do. And that writing can be an act of activism and justice, bringing justice to the world. So I really love hearing your take on that. So as we wrap things up, I always like to end with the same question. And the question is, if writers could do one thing to help themselves get published, basically, if you could boil down all of the nuggets of wisdom you've already shared on this episode to one thing that writers could do to help themselves get published, what would that one thing be?
Oh, God, that's so hard.
I know, I saved the easiest for last, don't I?
I wish there was one thing that you could say or do. But one thing that I suggest that I think I hear too often is never stop reading, because people say, oh, well, you know, I'm doing my own now. I don't have time anymore. Almost everybody, very few people just say, oh, I'm going to be a writer. I know there are big bucks in that. Very few people just, you know, come into it that way. People come into it because they love it. They love books and they're, you know, inspired to write from what they've read. I think sometimes if we don't, you know, keep up with all the wonderful things, not all of them, nobody can do that, but you know what I mean? If we don't keep up with some, you know, getting into some good books, you forget your passion. You know, you forget why you're doing this to begin with, like how much you want to tell a good story. So I think that's really important. And then the other thing is, as we were saying before, think of yourself as a writer. Sit down and write. Whatever your time is, use that time and sit down and be consistent. Keep at it.
I love that advice, and especially the reading part, which we didn't dive in as much. I mean, for me, one of the reasons I love doing podcasts is that it gives me an excuse to read people's books, and I can call it my job. I can be like, I'm reading for a living. So just out of curiosity, what are you reading right now?
I'm reading, now I just read his last name. I just picked it up. It's the same fellow who wrote The Devil in the White City, but he's wonderful. I love his work, and he's nonfiction. And I also just picked up a really great book on Jack the Ripper. And
some light bedtime reading.
I think on my bedstand, I have books everywhere. I think I have it. Kathy Reichs. I love Kathy Reichs too. And Linda Fairstein, I love her stuff. So I think I have one of those in the car. especially people who have children. I mean, I think that the reading is the most wonderful thing in the world, because you know, when you're in that car line and you're going to sit there for 20 minutes because, you know, the cars are just lined up for everybody to get the kids, you have a book so that, you know, you don't feel like you're going to have to come out of the car and smack somebody. The same thing at a doctor's office, your appointment's at 11, you're not going to get to see them until 2 or 3. If you have a book with you, it's okay. You don't, you know, you don't get as upset as you would if you were just, you know, sitting there staring at the wall. So, I mean, I know there are games and things like that too, but for me, it's books.
Well, and there's nothing worse than being stuck out somewhere waiting and not having a book with you. Like, that is my seventh circle of hell. It has been such a pleasure chatting with you today, Heather. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I just loved getting to chat with you. Thank you.
All right, everyone. That about wraps it up for today. Now stop listening and go get writing. Thank you for listening to the Writer's Digest podcast with Gabriella Pereira, founder of DIYMFA.com. This podcast was edited by Marielle Orff, and special thanks goes out to Samantha Sanders, Tyler Moss, and Jess Zafaris.